before, they will be Ben-Gvir and the so the Jewish Power Party and the Religious Zionist Party together will form a new militia of 200,000 colonists. They will that are already
okay. God, I think we lost you, Laith Maruf. I'm sorry, but at the same time, we're fresh out of time. Let me thank Laith Maruf. Sorry about that. Laith Maruf, activist and political commentator. And Saad Nimr, thank you, professor of political science at Birzeit University. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight from Mikko Vatavoy and the team. It's goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. Next, you will hear recitation of verse 21. Of chapter Ibrahim from the Holy Quran, recited by Mr. Reza Yan.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Wa barazu lillahi jami'an faqala ضعفاء للذين استكبروا إنا كنا لكم تبعا فهل أنتم مغنون عنا من عذاب الله من شيء قالوا سواء علينا علينا أجزعنا أم صبرنا ما لنا من محيص صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful. And they shall all come forth before Allah. Then the weak shall say to those who were proud, "Surely we were your followers. Can you therefore avert from us any part of the chastisement of Allah?" They would say, "If Allah had guided us, we too would have guided you. It is the same to us whether we are impatient now or patient. There is no place for us to fly to."
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Palestinians are waking up this morning to news of more Israeli bloodshed in the occupied West Bank. Iran says Eutelsat's SAT's decision to suspend services to Press TV proves that the Western claims of advocating free speech are all but a sham. Plus, enough is enough. The South Korean government is ordering thousands of striking truckers to get back to work as soon as possible. Thank you for joining us. More bloodshed in the occupied West Bank. Israeli forces have killed three Palestinians during another raid they conducted just hours ago. The Israeli military stormed into the Jenin refugee camp early on Thursday. Several other Palestinians have been injured. Authorities in the Jenin governorate have declared a day of public mourning to commemorate the tragedy. Meanwhile, the resistance movement Hamas has reacted by saying the Israeli crimes will only make Palestinians more resolute in their resistance. Regime forces have on numerous occasions attacked the Flashpoint camp as part of a crackdown on Palestinian fighters and their families. So far this year, the military attacks have claimed the lives of well above 200 Palestinians in the occupied West Bank and the besieged Gaza Strip. Here's Muna Kandil, our correspondent from Ramallah, with the latest about the latest deadly encounter in the occupied West Bank. Let's listen to that.
Israeli forces have raided another Palestinian area in the occupied West Bank. Early Thursday, Israeli troops raided Jenin city, northern the occupied West Bank, and its refugee camp. According to the Israeli military, the aim of the operation was to arrest Palestinians accused of being wanted for security reasons, accused by the Israeli forces of taking part in anti-Israel activities, different forms of resistance. But as usual, raiding the refugee camp of Jenin means that the clashes would be taking place because the residents there, Palestinian fighters there, would not accept for the Israeli forces to enter easily. Clashes took place between Palestinians there and Israeli soldiers that led to the killing of three Palestinians, Sidqi Zakarni, Ata Shalabi, and Tariq Adamaj from Jenin refugee camp and from Qabatia. According to our sources there, the three who were killed were not wanted by the Israeli forces. Two of them were already heading to their work while they were surprised by the Israeli troops and military bulldozer inside the refugee camp, whom immediately soldiers opened fire in cold, killing people in cold blood and wounded a number of them.
Now, Iran's foreign ministry spokesman strongly condemns a decision by European satellite operator Eutelsat to take English language news channel Press TV off the air. Nasser Kanani said the move further reveals the true colors of false advocates of freedom of expression and the free flow of information. He added that while Europe hosts TV channels that foment violence and terrorism inside Iran, it removes Press TV from Eutelsat over the European Union's sanctions against the channel. His remarks came after Eutelsat warned Press TV that it will take the broadcaster off the air. Press TV has strongly condemned Eutelsat's decision, criticizing the EU for being behind the move.
This is the same Europe which is openly hosting numerous broadcasters that are hostile to the Islamic Republic of Iran and is turning a blind eye to hate mongering and dissemination of fake news against Iran. The European Union is aware that Press TV reflects the real image of the continent to both the bloc and the world, and that the channel fights against attempts to paint a dark picture of Iran.
Press TV says the move is part of the West's continuous attempts to silence the voice of the Iranian people. It's also criticized the West's double standards when it comes to freedom of speech. Nonetheless, Press TV says it will continue to do its utmost in order to remain the voice of the voiceless. This is not the first time that Western governments have tried to block the Iranian news networks. The channel's website, YouTube account, and other social media platforms have been targeted several times before.
It's just another attempt to mute the voice of the voiceless. Press TV managers were not surprised by Eutelsat's decision to stop broadcasting the news outlet, as they say this is not the first time Press TV is being banned in the West.
Well, this gesture by the West is not anything new in terms of Press TV and even some of its, sister channels. So it puts under the microscope the real intention behind this. So the way this appears to be is that it's part of a bigger picture of this maximum pressure campaign that's been exerted on Iran. I am sure there's some geopolitical interest involved in terms of trying to limit Iran's reach when it comes to the media. But in particular, obviously, another reason for this act by the West, which is really against the pillars that they actually advocate, which is freedom of speech.
Eutelsat is a French satellite operator providing coverage over the entire European continent, the Middle East, Africa, Asia, and the Americas. It is the world's third largest satellite operator in terms of revenues. In mid-November, the European Union imposed sanctions on Press TV over claims that the news network airs forced confessions of detainees in connection with the recent unrest in Iran.
I've been working here at Press TV for almost a decade now, and I can tell you that Press TV has not aired any confessions whatsoever, forced or unforced. So that shows you how such decisions by the EU and the like are based on unfounded claims with no basis in reality. And these sanctions on Press TV I see as part of the media war and their narrative control. They want to present the war with their distorted version of what's going on in Iran these days, and seemingly they don't feel much comfortable with Press TV challenging their narrative. So they would try everything to silence us or make us less heard, but we're not going to be silenced.
In 2013, Press TV was brought off the air in the UK after media regulator Ofcom revoked its license over alleged breaching of its rules. In the same year, it was taken off the air in North America after the U.S. Treasury Department placed sanctions against the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. Press TV was also dropped from the Galaxy 19 satellite platform that allowed it to be broadcast in the United States and Canada. Press TV has also repeatedly fallen victim to censorship on multiple social media platforms, including Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube.
It's not the first time, and perhaps not the last time, that the West has attempted to pull the plug on Press TV. However, the news network says it will continue its professional journalism based on its motto of being a voice for the voiceless. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
And in South Korea, another 10,000 striking truckers will have to return to work as nationwide walkouts are causing havoc in the economy. The government is now widening back-to-work orders to drivers transporting steel, fuel, and chemicals. Last week, it ordered cement truckers to return to work. The strikes have triggered concerns as shipments of steel materials were down to about 50% compared to normal levels. Also, petrochemical products were shipping at only 20% of normal levels. Truckers who refuse to get back to work could be fined, jailed, or may even lose their license. The strikes started last month. The truckers are demanding that a minimum freight rate wage become permanent, but the government is refusing to extend it beyond the current 3 years. Frank Smith is our correspondent in the South Korean capital, Seoul, and joins us now. Frank, welcome. So, no breakthrough in the negotiations between the government and the unions. Essentially, the truckers are being forced or threatened, whichever way you look at it, to get back to work.
Yes, they are. Prime Minister Han Duck-soo came out today announcing that the government has ordered the steel and petrochemical drivers to get back to work. That order was signed by President Yoon Suk-yeol this morning as well. The concern here for the government and for industries has to do with operations, particularly at steel mills. As steel is not shipped, they have trouble in terms of storage, and then they can't produce more steel and have to turn off the blast furnaces at these. There are something like, I think, 5 or 7 large blast furnaces in the country steel production is a primary industry here. If they shut down a blast furnace, it then takes a long time, weeks, in fact, to start up again. So this could have kind of ongoing effects even after a strike is resolved, costing the economy something like billions of dollars a day now. It wasn't since 2004, since the government ordered workers back onto their jobs. What the drivers want, you mentioned it briefly, is an extension of the safe trucking freight rate system that provides truckers with a minimum wage. They also want to see it extended. Right now, it just sort of applies to a few categories of truckers, but not all kind of delivery drivers, and they want to see that system also expanded. Among the threats that you mentioned were fines up to $20,000, as well as potentially 3 years behind bars. Also, you know, what we're talking about is really some raw materials here, steel and petrochemicals, oil, that type of thing, and that can, again, also have runoff effects throughout the South Korean economy, including the auto industry, including shipbuilding, not receiving the steel that they need to fill orders, as well as microchips. So there can be a lot of kind of run-on effects, but I was out at a demonstration on the weekend, and I heard from some of the truckers, and their concern is that these back-to-work orders infringe on their right to go on strike and to seek what they say is a livable wage here.
Right, so one can understand the government's position regarding the economy. On the other hand, unions have called Yoon's order to get back to work the equivalent of martial law. Are we expecting any further negotiations between the two sides?
Well, not at this time. I haven't heard of any announcements of negotiations. Certainly, there are probably back-channel discussions that are taking place. As of last week, a couple of negotiations ended in shouting of the two sides within minutes of beginning. So, you know, this strike also has gone on for 15 days. The previous strike in June just extended the safe trucking freight rate system through to the end of this year. It had been announced about 3 years ago. It had been agreed about 3 years ago, and then it was extended just through the end of this year. So it expires at the end of this month. And they want to see it renewed. That previous strike in the spring lasted just 8 days. So already we're into 15 days. This is kind of an unprecedented length of a walkout for the truckers to try to resolve sort of long-term wage and industry issues.
Indeed. Frank, thanks a lot for that. Frank Smith there, our correspondent, joining us live from the South Korean capital, Seoul. Now, tensions over Taiwan are simmering, with China expressing outrage at a visit by an Australian delegation to the island. The U.S. considers Australia as a frontline state in countering Chinese economic and political moves. Late last month, the U.S. announced its plan to deploy 6 nuclear-capable B-52 bombers in northern Australia. So do these developments indicate that Canberra is siding with Washington to counter Beijing's rising power in the Indo-Pacific?
A group of Australian lawmakers has arrived in Taiwan despite warnings from Beijing over the visit at a time of rising tensions over the self-ruled island.
There's a group of bipartisan members of the parliament from Australia currently visiting Taiwan. They are already here. We appreciate that the Australian parliament is very friendly to Taiwan.
Taipei's foreign ministry stated that the members of the delegation will meet the territory's president and other officials during their 5-day visit. The ministry added the meetings will focus on a wide array of issues of mutual interest. The Chinese foreign ministry expressed opposition to the trip, calling on Canberra to respect the One China principle.
Taiwan is an inalienable part of Chinese territory. The One China policy is a recognized norm of international relations, and it is also the prerequisite and political basis for China to develop friendly relations with other countries. The Australian side should earnestly abide by the One China policy, stop any form of official exchanges with the Taiwan region.
Under the One China policy, Beijing considers Taiwan a breakaway province that should be reunited with the mainland. The spokesperson also warned Australia against official exchanges with Taiwan, calling on Canberra to stop sending wrong signals to separatist forces in Taiwan. The visit to Taiwan comes as Australia's recently elected Labour government has moved to repair its estranged diplomatic relations with China. Last month, Australian Prime Minister Anthony Albanese met China's President Xi Jinping at the G20 summit in Bali, Indonesia. But the parliamentary trip to Taiwan would cast a shadow on attempts to build ties between Beijing and Canberra. Albanese sought to play down the mission's significance after it was first reported. He insisted the visit was separate from government business, saying there have been backbench visits to Taiwan for a long time. Australia had long maintained it didn't have to choose between China and the U.S., but in recent years, its attitude toward Beijing has revealed where it stands in the world. Signing the AUKUS security pact with the U.S. and U.K. and rotational presence of American forces in Australia are a testament to Canberra taking the side of the U.S. over China.
Turning elsewhere, Peru's Vice President Dina Boluarte has been sworn in as interim president after Congress voted overwhelmingly to oust President Pedro Castillo. In an address to Congress, but Boluarte said she will hold the post in accordance with the country's constitution until July 2026. That's when Castillo's term would have ended. The swearing-in ceremony came after Congress impeached Castillo with 101 votes in favor. The move was taken after Castillo declared a state of emergency, saying the country will be governed by decree law until the new Congress convenes. The announcement sparked resignations by key ministers, and now the opposition accused the president of orchestrating a coup and corruption. Castillo was detained by security forces shortly after his removal. The United States has welcomed the removal of the leftist leader, calling him former president. That brings an end to our World Bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
This is the Heart of Life pounding. IRIB English Radio.
The Supplication on Thursdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who has taken away the shadowy night by His power and brought the sight-giving day through His mercy. He has clothed me in its brightness and given me its favor. O Allah, just as Thou hast spared me for this day, so also spare me for its likes. Bless the Prophet Muhammad and his household, and torment me not in it and in other nights and days by allowing me to commit unlawful acts and to clothe myself in sins. Provide me with its good, the good of all within it, and the good of everything after it, and turn away from me its evil, the evil of all within it, and the evil of everything after it. O Allah, by the protective compact of Islam, I seek mediation with Thee, and by the inviolability of the Quran, I rely upon Thee. By Muhammad, the Chosen, Allah bless him and his household, I seek intercession with Thee, so recognize my protective compact, by which I hope my need will be granted. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, decree for me on Thursday five things, which none embraces but Thy generosity, and none supports but Thy favors. Health through which I may have the strength to obey Thee. Worship by which I may deserve Thy plentiful reward. Plenty in my state through lawful provision. And that Thou makest me secure in the places of fear through Thy security. And placest me in Thy fortress against the striking of worries and sorrows. Bless Muhammad and his household. And make my seeking his mediation as an intercessor give profit on the day of resurrection. Surely, Thou art the most merciful of the merciful.
houses exalted by God and desecrated by the godless. In the name of God, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Salam, dear listeners, and condolences to you all on a very tragic day. Today is the 13th of the month of Jamadi al-Awwal, the day the most noblest lady of all times achieved martyrdom 75 days after the departure of her illustrious father from the mortal world. Her grief in the brief period that she lived after her father was profound because of the calamities she had suffered at the hands of those who had usurped her inheritance, deprived her husband of his right of political leadership of the Ummah, and smashed the door of her house upon her. She was none other than Hazrat Fatima Zahra, peace upon her, the immaculate daughter of the Almighty's last and greatest messenger, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Before we present you a special feature on this tragic anniversary of the supreme symbol of all feminine virtues, here is Ayah 36 of Surah Nur of the Noble Quran regarding houses sanctified by God Almighty. In houses Allah has allowed to be exalted, and wherein His name is celebrated, He is glorified therein, morning and evening. The renowned Sunni scholar Tha'labi, in his exegesis of the Noble Quran titled Tafsir al-Kabir, has mentioned on the authority of Anas ibn Malik and Buraida that, when asked about the divinely exalted houses, the Prophet said the reference is to the abodes of the prophets. At this, Abu Bakr stood up and asked, O Messenger of God, is the house of Ali and Fatima also among those houses? The Prophet replied, yes, rather the greater one of those houses. Indeed, this is the gist of undeniable truth. In view of the fact that Ayahs 3 and 4 of Surah Najm state that Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, never speaks of his own desire, and whatever he says is divinely inspired. In other words, the expressions of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, are articles of faith, and any doubt about their meaning, intent, and purport places a big question mark on the faith of the doubter. God knows the fate of the persons also directly heard from the Prophet and yet disobeyed him. History, however, bears testimony that no sooner did the Prophet leave the mortal world, a group of his companions who usurped the caliphate or political rule of the state in order to deprive Imam Ali, peace upon him, of divine right of political leadership, violated the sanctity of the blessed threshold of the Immaculate Fatima, peace upon her. As all authentic books of hadith have mentioned, this group of roadies did not stop at their loud threats and rude rappings of the door where the Prophet used to salute every morning after revelation of Ayah 33 of Surah Ahzab on the pristine purity of the Ahlul Bayt. They blasphemously set fire to the door and smashed it upon Fatima, peace upon her, the paragon of all virtues. The result of this sacrilege was broken ribs and miscarriage for the Prophet's daughter, as the stillborn Mohsen became the first martyr of the Ahlul Bayt, ironically killed by those styling themselves the political heirs of the Prophet. This is the reason we are clad in black today on the 13th of Jamadi al-Awwal to commemorate the martyrdom of the Pride of the Virgin Mary, who following this shocking incident had turned into a faded flower in the prime of youth, walking with the aid of a stick and reciting the heart-rending elegy, "O Father, had the calamities that befell me after you were to fall on bright days, they would have turned into dark nights." Several questions arise on the anniversary of this calamity. Why did the regime that had seized power in Medina from those exalted by God desecrate the divinely decreed sanctity of a blessed house? Why did the principal attacker threaten to burn down the whole house, along with the four little grandchildren of the Prophet inside it, the boys Imam Hassan and Imam Hussein, and the girls Zainab and Umm Kulthum, peace upon them? Had he and his accomplices not seen the Prophet interrupting his sermon from the pulpit to come down and take his elder grandson in his arms when the boy tipped and fell while entering the Prophet's mosque? Was he not in the row of prostrating worshippers when the Prophet prolonged the prostration before lifting his head only after the toddler Hussein, peace upon him, the younger grandson, had gotten off his back? Didn't this person witness the triumph of Islam over Christianity at the historic field of Mubahale when, as per God's commandment in Ayah 61 of Surah Al Imran, the Prophet took with him for a unique challenge to sift truth from falsehood, no one else except his daughter, her two sons, and her husband, the impeccable Imam Ali, peace upon him? Moreover, why did these usurpers confiscate Fatima's patrimony of the orchard of Fadak that was given to her by her father in his lifetime as a small compensation for the vast wealth of her mother, Umm al-Mu'minin Khadija, peace upon her, who died penniless after spending all her riches to clothe, feed, and shelter the persecuted neo-Muslims of Mecca? Many more questions flash across our minds when we recall this first ever act of terrorism in the history of Islam by persons hailed as Salaf or progenitors by today's seditious Salafi Takfiri cannibalistic terrorists who masquerade as Muslims to desecrate mosques and shrines, massacre innocent men, women and children, and eat livers and other organs of their human victims. The answer is obvious. Terrorists and traitors have no religion. In pursuit of ulterior political motives, they pay mere lip service to nationalistic tendencies in order to promote a free-willing life of paganism. Since the Prophet's Ahlul Bayt are bulwarks of monotheism and the virtuous way of life, these enemies of humanity assault houses exalted by God. Hazrat Fatima Zahra, peace upon her, thus did not court martyrdom without any cause or for the loss of any earthly possession and worldly status. In fact, the lady whom God hails in the Noble Quran as Kauthar, or a spring of perpetual abundance, endured all these calamities for the sake of God. In defense of the mission of her father, especially the fundamental principle of velayat, or divinely decreed succession to nubuwwat, for the guidance of human societies that was vested in her husband, Imam Ali, peace upon him, on the day of Qadir, 18th of Dhul-Hajjah, 10 AH, on revelation of Ayah 67 of Surah Ma'idah, she risked her life. The ill-begotten terrorist burst into her house to take Imam Ali, peace upon him, for a forced swearing of allegiance to the coup leaders. But as pointed out by this immaculate lady in her famous sermon in the Prophet's Mosque, they exposed themselves as usurpers of the political leadership of the Ahlul Bayt for all time. This is evident by the mass murderers, fornicators, adulterers, drunkards, and the godless who throughout history opposed God-oriented systems through different means, even posing as caliphs. No wonder Hazrat Fatima Zahra, peace upon her, had predicted when she left the mosque after addressing the usurpers as part of her electrifying sermon on the fundamentals of Islam and the facts of the neo-Muslim society that had emerged from centuries of ignorance, idol worship, dirtiness, and all kinds of sins. Now hang to this cheap dromedary of caliphate of yours, and release it not. But beware, the hump of this camel is injured, while there are blisters and holes in its feet. It carries the scars of ignominy and the sign of wrath of Allah. Eternal shame is attached to it.
This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
This is called football. Football players have many fans. Even if you play in an ordinary team, millions of people will know you. same with the coaches. They also have their own fans. The domain of the support reaches the people who are on the sidelines of football as well. Anyone who's involved with the green rectangle will one way or another become famous and popular. In the middle of all of this, there's an exception. The referees. They are not popular. Their professional activity is not attractive to fans, and they never become a star. For fans, referees are as important as the security forces on the sidelines of the field or the supervisors of matches. Let's think about it right now. How many players do we know? On the other hand, how many referees do we know by their names or appearance? This is why referees shoulder one of the biggest responsibilities of football games. The story is usually like this. The referee is the least known person among the people who run on the field. They get the least amount of money, and they give flack more than everyone else. Everyone expects them to be flawless and restore calm in a match just like a skilled orchestra conductor. The pressure on the judge reveals itself in the World Cup more than any other time. A world of responsibility is hidden behind the whistle blown in the World Cup. The referees are the most important neglected part of the World Cup. January 30th, 1930, when Uruguay faced Argentina in the final match of the first World Cup, officiating a match had no resemblance to what we see today. John Langanis, who was the referee who had put on a coat on his sports shorts, he's even worn a tie. Ulises Salcido, the assistant referee, had coached Bolivia at the earlier stage. The biggest problem for the referees was all the teams had brought their own footballs and they wanted to play with their footballs. In fact, officiating a football match gradually morphed into what we know today. Until the 1970 World Cup, the referees would go without yellow or red cards or send the players off.
Trocha goes first. The captain sent off a kicking Emmerich.
Or until the 1994 World Cup. They could only wear black shirts. And until recent World Cups, there were no fourth referees. Besides all of this, the laws to officiate a match were different. Until the 1990 World Cup, the goalkeepers were allowed to handle the ball passed to them by a teammate, or until the 1998 World Cup, diving or faking injuries by players wouldn't get a yellow card. Something hasn't changed compared to those days. The referees still undergo the most intense pressure. No one is optimistic about the referees. Players, coaches, the media, fans, officials with the FIFA referees committee, or even politicians. So, in recent years, FIFA has paid special attention to World Cup referees. Nowadays, referee teams are supervised well ahead of the games. They take various tests in several stages. They take part in preparation camps and get to know the latest technologies. FIFA tries to choose the best referees on the planet, men or women with green characters, greater than off-the-field issues and the usual pressure of the World Cup.
I want to thank you, and I want to congratulate you that you have been chosen now for this 2014 journey. You will be my team. You will be FIFA's president's team number 33 in the World Cup. And this is a very important one.
Officiating a match today is easier than the days Langunas was running after the sun-scorched Argentine players at Estadi Centenari. The special spray, telecommunication technology, the technology to decide whether the ball has passed the goal line, and who knows, maybe even video check. But this isn't the end of the concerns. It only takes a mistake or a suspicious decision on part of a referee to make a mess, especially in an international event that's tied with national pride and patriotism for many people. The fate of all World Cup games are tied to the controversial decisions by the referees. If those decisions hadn't been made, history would have been different.
Charlton and his fellow sharpshooters came back time after time in the Ramsey spirit, believing that with sustained attack, the goals must come. Then Jeff Hurst, cool and collected, had the ball in the net. It bounced out.
Maybe the strong shot by Jeff Hurst in that hard final match was the hardest decision to make in the history of refereeing a match. No one was sure if the ball had entered the goal. No one knows even now. Tofikh Bahramov, the Russian lineman's decision was in favor of the host, Britain. He decided that the ball passed the line.
And the linesmen say yes. Yes.
It was the 101st minute. The Wembley Stadium burst into cheer, and Britain was on the verge of achieving its biggest honor. It wasn't his first mistake in the World Cup. A little earlier in the quarterfinals, Britain played against Argentina.
Now England and Argentina.
In the 35th minute, the referee sent Argentine player Antonio Ratin off. He said Ratin had used swear words. However, Ratin was speaking in Spanish and Rudolf Kraetlin didn't know that language. Ratin refused to get out for 8 minutes. Argentine players threatened that if the referees did not go back on their decision, they would get off the field. But the referee had made his decision. Argentina Argentina had to play with 10 men against the hosts, Britain, and lost the match. In that World Cup, when Uruguay faced West Germany in Sunderland's Roker Park, Schlenninger, a defender who used to play for AC Milan back then, fisted at a corner kick out of the goal. Everyone saw that scene except for the referee, who didn't believe it was a penalty.
And there's trouble already. There's a fight going on in the middle there. Well, this looks like turning into a real battle.
In the Chile-Italy match in 1962, the British referee Ken Aston sent two Italian players off in the first half, while Chilean players were playing rougher than the Italians.
David kicks out regardless of Sanchez's legs, and Lionel Sanchez, son of a boxing champion, knocks out David with a beautiful uppercut.
After the unjustifiable performance by the referee, the fans came up with the idea that FIFA sides with the host countries. The hunch stood out in the 1979 World Cup, when Egyptian Hassan Ali Khandil blew into the whistle and showed the Mexican side off the field, maybe mistakenly. Mario Perez realized that the referee believed that the Mexican side can possess the ball, but El Salvadorian players didn't notice that, and the first goal was scored. Protest was useless. And after that, the 1982 World Cup, with so many strange incidents related to the referees. During the match between Kuwait and France, head of the Kuwaiti Football Federation got into the field and made an objection. He said the fourth goal by the French side should have been dismissed. Fahad stayed on the field for such a long time until Miroslav Stupar was convinced the goal should be disallowed. The French side scored the fourth goal against Kuwait again. It was in the heavyweight semifinal when Harold Schumacher got out of the field and collided with Patrick Battiston. Battiston fainted, but Schumacher didn't even receive a yellow card.
Schumacher clearly makes no attempt to play the ball. He prefers Battiston. The French get no penalty. Schumacher stays on the field. Battiston is carried from it. And France are forced to use their second substitute.
France made a comeback from the 3-1 and got a 3-3 draw and lost the game to Schumacher's skills in the penalty shootouts and were barred from reaching the final. And the dramatic 1986 finals match, when Diego Maradona passed the ball above Peter Shilton with the hand of God.
France Valdana, he can't turn. Maradona's there, rises above Shilton. And is that goal going to be allowed? Schoot came out, Maradona challenged him. Peter Schoot is claiming he was fouled. And that goal is going to be allowed. The ball flicked through by Valdano. He turned it inside and it was a handball, no question about that. That was the only reason that Maradona was able to rise above the incensed Peter Schoot.
Nasser Ben Ali, the Tunisian referee, allowed the goal and Maradona ran across the Azteca Stadium to celebrate the goal. Who knows, maybe if the referee had announced that number 10 of Argentina had committed a foul, today the legendary Maradona would have looked differently. And the 1990 World Cup, when in a confrontation between Rijkaard and Rudi Völler, the Dutch player revealed all of his historical hatred by spitting on the German forward's face. And it wasn't a one-off incident. The referee didn't notice that. Later in the game, when Voller crashed into the Dutch goalkeeper, the brawl continued, and the judge decided to send both players off. Voller showed everyone the referee's poor judgment once again in those games. In the evening, when Maradona cried to say the German side did not deserve to walk out as the winners, Voller faked a fall to the ground to gain one of the most controversial penalties in World Cup history. France Beckenbauer's Germany won the nine-man Argentina after a penalty score by Andreas Brehme and became the World Cup champions. In 1998 in France, the biggest right decision in the history of the game was made. During the last minutes of the match between Brazil and Norway, Sven Bjørn Bahrmast showed the penalty spot in favor of Norway. 16 cameras were recording the scene, and neither of them showed any foul. Norway hammered the ball home, won the game, and moved on to the next stage. The Moroccan officials believed that everything was set in advance to remove their team from the World Cup, but later on, the images recorded by a Swedish camera showed the referee's masterpiece. He had noticed a foul where no one else did. Now, whenever officiating that match is mentioned, everyone remembers the scene, not the strange dismissal of Laurent Blanc. And we think about South Korea in 2002. Officiating the matches in that edition was in favor of the hosts to the degree that even the most optimistic supervisors got suspicious.
Tony's in trouble. In fact, it's a straight red. Off. It's a nine-man Portugal as Beto.
Two Portuguese players got red cards in the group stage, and South Korea won the match 1-0. And next, their encounter with Italy. South Korean intentionally hit the Italian players, but they weren't sent off. Totti was sent off instead for what the referee thought was a dive while Totti tripped on his feet. The third victims of the wrong judgment were Spain, two goals of whom were disallowed. In that year, Rivaldo faked an injury and the Turkish player received a red card, but the incident was buried under the pile of uproar by the Koreans.
Grosso, and still Grosso, he's done brilliantly, play on, says the referee.
Many people remember the 2006 World Cup with a controversial penalty kick after a foul on Fabio Grosso.
Neil went to ground, Grosso fell over his prostrate body. I think it's more than debatable. It looks a shocker of a decision, to be honest. It's Totti versus Schwarzer.
And many others, with Josip Simunić's dismissal. In that match, Graham Paul showed 3 yellow cards to the Croatian player and finally sent him off. The referees in that year were not kind to the Croatian. And the 2010 games, it was a repeat of what had happened in Wembley 44 years back, this time around in South Africa. The unstoppable kick by Frank Lampard, the goalpost, the line, and the referee who didn't see it as a goal. It's true, the history of World Cup is replete with goals that were mistakenly disallowed, the players who were mistakenly dismissed, and the fouls that went unnoticed. Who knows what the history of the World Cup would look like without so many mistakes. They are what they are expected to be. Resolute and calm people who make the best decisions in the most sensitive times. The games are fast, attractive, and fair thanks to their intelligence and accuracy. If they make a mistake, even their smallest mistakes can change history. In the outburst of color, light, and sound, in the largest festival in the world, the cameras focus on the superstars. No one notices the referees unless a crisis turns everyone's head to them. We can watch the referees as well. We can watch them do their best to manage the most sensitive scenes of sports. Watching the audacity and courage of a man who runs on a field dotted with mines.